Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us. As you can tell, we're doing something a little bit different today than we usually do. I got another long interview this hour, a wonderful conversation with Dr. Jacob Imam. I think one of the most interesting people in the church today, the founder of the College of St. Joseph the Worker and the founder of New Polity. We'll talk to him about what Catholics are up to these days, what the hopes are for the church, and why he's founding these institutions like the College of St. Joseph the Worker. Dr. Imam is a convert to the Catholic faith from Islam, and who helped him into the church? C.S. Lewis's personal secretary, Walter Hooper. Here's Dr. Jacob Imam.
Jacob Imam, thank you very much for being here with us.
I'm really delighted to be.
I just want to see if I can sum this up properly, because I feel like your story is a common story. We've heard it a million times, of a Muslim who's brought into the Catholic Church by C.S. Lewis's secretary, study theology and economics at Oxford, and now you don't believe Catholics should own stocks.
That's right.
It's an everyday story. I've heard it a million times.
Run of the mill.
But first of all, C.S. Lewis's secretary, just let's start there, because it's like, really? So you were born in a Muslim household.
Well, my father was
a
Muslim.
Muslim.
Yeah,
okay.
He was born and raised in Jerusalem. So he's actually born in the old city walls. His grandfathers had moved over. I mean, his ancestors moved, as far as we can tell, sometime in the 9th century, they moved over to Jerusalem.
That's as far back as you can go.
And we know that they were all clerics of some stripe or another, right? And so even as close as his grandfather was actually the imam of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
What?
You know, which is on the site of the Temple Mount.
This story gets better and better. So that's your grandfather or his grandfather? Your great-grandfather.
My great-grandfather. Okay. My father's great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather was the mufti, of Jerusalem. So in other words, the bishop, I guess, would be the closest.
Oh, really?
Like that we have in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And so they were clerics, really, in academics going all the way back. My grandfather bucked the trend, and that was actually kind of an interesting reason why he did, is that his father was ousted from his position because of some tension with Kaiser Wilhelm as he was entering into Jerusalem. There's tension. He didn't want to let him in. And so what resulted was that he was replaced.
Kaiser Wilhelm won, in other words,
yeah,
as
exactly.
He so often did.
Yeah, yeah, right. And so my grandfather had to find something else to do.
Really?
And so he started giving tours to people coming to the Holy Land. And he actually, despite being a Muslim, went to a college to study New Testament archaeology. To be a pro at it, and created the first local travel agency in the Holy Land. And that was, a trend in a new direction for the family, quite an interesting one, I think. And then my father was raised up also in the hospitality industry, but when he was, when his arranged marriage kind of fell through, there's all these different steps in the negotiation process that they didn't come to actually getting a signed document, which is, the ceremony, right? That he had some freedom to choose somebody else. And there just so happened to be this beautiful white woman from Michigan that was living in Jerusalem at the time.
This really is a common story. Yeah. Man, if I've heard it once, I've heard it a million times. Okay.
And that was my mom.
And why was she there? Why is your mom living in Jerusalem?
You know what? It's not that interesting of a reason. She was a study abroad student at Michigan State University, and she was studying hotel management. And so she thought, well, if I have an opportunity of studying international hotel management, why wouldn't I go to Jerusalem? That sounds like fun, right?
Yeah.
So she was working at the Seven Arches Hotel on the
I have never been to Jerusalem.
I'm ashamed to tell you
not
that.
Yet.
No. Not yet. That's right. Not yet.
There you go.
Maybe this time next year.
And it's a very safe place to go. So,
well, I'm willing.
Despite what the news says. Yeah.
The flights are expensive. That's been my main problem.
Yeah. And so she went over there and worked and met my dad, who could barely speak a lick of English at the time, but they kicked it off. And That's what happened. She, you know, so he was a Muslim, you know, and he was raised in this very traditional and I would say a relatively powerful Muslim family in the old city. And she was a lapsed Catholic. That's almost even too generous to say. Her family, when she was 11 years old, left the church.
Oh, yeah. So,
over Humanae Vitae. And so, which is actually quite interesting because my grandmother, who just passed away, may she rest in peace, had 8 kids at this time.
And she just was not taking this Humanae Vitae thing,
though, huh? Yeah. Wow. At that point, I was like, 8 kids, just keep going, man. But for them, and I'll just say this as a tangential aside because it's opening up a can of worms, is that they were hearing from the pulpit, my grandma and grandpa, they were hearing from the pulpit that the church was now accepting of contraception. And then all of a sudden, Humanae Vitae comes out and says the exact opposite. So they're hearing two different magisteria,
right?
That it's okay and it's not okay. Well, if there's a contradiction here, then it's not really Christ's church.
No.
Now, of course, there were underlying issues beyond that kind of technical piece, but that was something real for them and an excuse that they could kind of latch onto. And so when they were... my mom was 11 at the time, and so when she ran over to Jerusalem, it wasn't with any faith really that she was real relationship with God.
Did they come back here? Is that what happened?
They met there, they married there, they lived there for some time, and then really in order to avoid the occupation, they moved to the States.
Oh, right. Yeah. Because those were horrible years then. After the late 1960s into 70s, mm-hmm. those were horrible years
they
in
were
the
tough.
Middle East.
They were really tough.
Okay. Yeah. So Michigan, I guess a lot of Arab-speaking people or Arabic-speaking people come to Michigan.
That's right. Yeah. Dearborn in particular. They went over to – they bounced around a few different areas in New York. But my dad, he received his undergraduate training at Bethlehem University, which at the time was unaccredited in the United States.
Oh, bummer.
And so he had to go through everything again. None of his classes transferred.
No transfers.
Isn't that crazy? And somehow he managed to complete a full BA degree in 18 months at Michigan State.
Good Lord.
Isn't that crazy? I couldn't imagine.
Wow.
So it's a bit quick.
Okay. So then you come along. So you're born in Michigan then.
New Jersey. They kept bouncing around a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Right. All right. So get us fast forward then. So you're Muslim, but with from this very prominent Muslim family, but you're raised in the U.S. It's a mixed family.
Yeah.
And so how attached are you to Islam? Like, do you?
Very little. Almost none.
I
would say, you know, so I think it's fair enough to claim being born into a Muslim home, but it's not fair enough to say a practicing Muslim, right?
Okay.
And that's not true.
You didn't have your own prayer rug or
I
don't know what qualifies you as a Muslim, but.
Yeah, I think, you know, actively holding on to the faith, you know, actively believing it. And I think I was so confused. I'll never forget being 4 years old and realizing for the first time that my parents believed something different about who God was and what the universe was. You know, kids pick up on this stuff, right?
It's amazing,
how much they do, right?
Right.
And so my mom's praying in the name of Jesus because she has now become a Protestant years later from this. I'm skipping large swaths of the story here. But she becomes a Protestant praying in the name of Jesus. And my dad just blows up about this. And of course, they pray differently. My mom's on her knees at the side of the bed. My dad's laying down. He's not a very practicing, you know, Muslim at this point in his life. But when he does, it's different, right, than my mom does. But just the animosity that's felt in the household, I'll never forget.
So you felt that from really this is your beginning awareness of life is.
But it's one of those images from childhood that's just so thick, right?
You know,
it's just
Yeah.
As if I was still there.
So you, were you in conflict about religion, about God? Did you have, did you internalize this conflict?
I did, you know, and they ended up sending me to a classical college prep Christian school, you know, and this was kind of a K through 12 spot. We had our nice little uniforms, all that. Great school. I really appreciate it. Learned a lot. But the classical part, where they took the Greco-Roman world seriously, did have a pretty dominating experience on my mind. I'd say that being introduced to the pantheon of the pagan world, of all these different gods with all these different things. And I was so confused at the time. My mom believed something different. My dad believed something different. It seems like the
Romans
ancients,
and the Greeks believed something different. Yeah.
Well, they're pretty much the same thing actually for them, right? And I thought, well, why? How do you even make a decision on this?
Right.
And I remember being something like 11 or 12 years old and thinking, I just don't have the capacity to make a decision on this. I'm going to have to punt on this for a few years.
So you reserved judgment.
I did. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I felt like I had to because it was such a big deal.
That doesn't seem unreasonable,
right?
At 11 years old. But you're reserving judgment. You're not making a decision that some make, which is all of this is baloney.
No.
You're reserving judgment to someday later make a decision.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought it was too important. It was like, it was obviously too important. And I don't think I could have articulated it that well at the time. But I think I could have said exactly that. This is just a bit too important not to know an answer to.
Okay.
And that's the extent of what I could have possibly said.
Would you say that you sought and searched, or would you say you just kind of let it marinate?
I really just punted. I just tried desperately not to think about it because I was getting pretty depressed over it.
Okay. Got to take a quick break now, but we'll continue with our conversation with Dr. Jacob Imam and an extraordinary life. Lots more to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Something a little bit different today on Catholic Answers Live, taking the time to have some longer conversations with some fascinating people. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Jacob Imam. All right, so how do you end up with Walter Hooper, C.S. Lewis's secretary?
13, 14 years old, same school. We went through all of sacred scripture. Well, you know, it was a Protestant place, so they missed a few books in the Old Testament. And that was very transformative because finally, even though I didn't believe it actively, I at least understood the larger arc of sacred history in the testaments. And that was very helpful. It's like, all right, at least I know what I'm getting my
teeth into. It's like a you are here kind of map.
Yeah. So, okay. Or at least now I know what Christians believe, generally speaking, right?
Right.
And it was kind of at the end of that time, 14 moving into 15, where I actually did have a real experience of my sin. I was very convicted that the world was not as it should be, and I was an active part of ensuring that it wasn't. And that was something that was so helpful to being able to have a real ability to start answering some of these questions. Right?
Do you think that conviction was a natural part of your adolescence, or do you think there was a supernatural prompting or you know, both. But do you see what I'm saying? Do you think that there was grace was pushing you to that? Because it kind of seems like a big insight for a 15-year-old.
Well, maybe. But I remember very clearly, it was kind of summer right before my 15th birthday, going to a church with this girl I really liked at the time, and thinking and listening to this youth pastor who said, who just kind of gave a challenge to all the kids that were there and saying, I challenge you just for 1 month, don't listen to any bad music, don't watch any bad movies. And I was kind of getting on a kick, you know, being like trying to be an athlete and stuff like that about discipline and all that stuff. I said, you know, it's like, and he said, oh, and this is what made like really, you know, sunk the nail into the coffin was he said, I bet you guys can't do it. And I was like, I will show you, you know.
A good youth pastor.
Yeah, I know. Natalie, thinking back, it's like, that was a really interesting choice that he made, but man, it worked for me. And so I, you know, it was not for any kind of moral conviction or even exercise. Yeah. I'd say it was purely one of discipline. And at the end of that month, I thought, oh my gosh, like there is something totally wrong with what's going on. Now I'd say it's like morally depraved, but at the time I was just thinking, there's something wrong. It's like in the world as it should be is not the world where it is.
Yeah.
And that was very clear. And so absolutely that was a prompting of grace. And that was the backstory for why it happened, as silly as it was, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the Lord, I think. I don't know if you're he's got his means to get through to us. They're not the means that we would have thought of.
Yeah,
but he uses all kinds of things. And I actually think, did you have a fear of hell then?
No, not fear of hell. Not at all. No, that was okay. Not. I don't think. Yeah, okay. No, I don't think so. Yeah,
you just. Yeah. It was an observation about this world that
this world.
It could be this. It's not that.
Yep.
But also, this was personalized to you by the fact that you couldn't do it. You couldn't be good.
Oh yeah,
the good person that you wanted to be.
Oh yeah,
is that right?
Or just the thought that I should be, and so that's when it was very helpful to then say, okay, now there's some marker, some precept that I now have by which to evaluate other things, right? And so it was very easy for me to say, okay, so that, all that pagan, the Greco-Roman stuff, that's wrong because those gods are just as arbitrary as we are.
Right.
And they can't provide a standard. I mean, this is a classic Euthyphro problem, right, that Plato brings up, right?
Right.
And so where does goodness even come from?
Had you read the Euthyphro at that point?
No.
Oh, so this is a felt experience of the problem of where do I – what is good and where did it come from?
Right, absolutely. Okay. But not a unique question is what I'm trying to say by referencing something very old, right? And so that was just immediately I could dismiss. Then the second thing was my father's faith, right? And from seeing the character of Allah as described in the Quran, that I was not convinced that he really was – willing to be long-suffering in the way that the text sometimes claims. And so seeing the world as it was, as you know, as perverted as I was then experiencing it, I was thinking it just is unconvincing that Allah would actually let it exist for this long without
knock it off, people.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Right.
And just sending prophets wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Like it just didn't square with the character that was described of him. You know, like the story and the character didn't seem to mesh, and that was the problem.
Right.
And then I looked over at my mom's Protestant faith at the time and thinking, oh, no, actually this story – it actually makes sense. And there's not – instead of saying, as Allah does, regarding your sin, do better, try harder, there was something that was substantially done to rectify that issue that Jesus Christ did on the cross.
Because do better, try harder is not an answer to sin.
No, it's not.
It doesn't solve the problem of sin. It doesn't heal the problem of sin.
Right.
But so you experienced the person of Jesus as offering that possibility?
I did.
Okay. All right. So it's a felt experience. This is not right.
Yeah.
It's a looking around. Well, what makes sense of that not rightness, or maybe could even address it. And the most appealing, convincing answer is the person of Jesus.
That's what I got. That was the best I could do, I think, at the time.
And it is the best you could do, actually, Jacob. Not at the time. That is the best you could do. No one's ever done better.
That's hilarious. I mean, I couldn't think any harder. I didn't have the capacity to think anymore. Like, okay. I didn't have any more training and such, right?
Yeah.
But that was really, you know, that's what did the trick, as it were, for me.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that it's so many people, like, who will say, we talk about this crisis of faith that we're in, the de-Christianizing of the world, and people will talk about a loss of a sense of sin as deadly, as spiritually deadly, that many people don't want what Christ offers because they don't experience or they don't acknowledge the experience of what it is that Christ heals, which is sin.
Right.
But somehow you had the felt experience of it. I wonder if there's anything in that we could take out, abstract from your experiences to help. Because the fact is, a lot of people say, I'm a good person.
Right.
And we don't want to say, well, you're not a good person, but we want to say, are you a good person in the way that you think, like, genuine goodness is? Because there's clearly a lot that's good about you, but I'm a good person is not an answer to life.
Yeah, no, it's yeah, and it's a bit silly, right?
Yeah.
Because if you actually take somebody out of the context of talking about spiritual things, religious things, they're not going to tell you that they're a good person. They're going to tell you most of the time
that
I'm struggling with this. I'm anxious all the time.
Right.
You know, I don't have a great relationship with my mom.
Lighting up a cigarette, drinking a whiskey. Go, I'm a good person. Really?
No. But I really think it's like you take them outside that context metaphysics.
Right.
And they're going to say, my life's in ruins.
Oh, that's right. That's right, Jacob. Yeah. Okay.
You know? So I think part of the thing that was helpful for me was that youth pastor didn't tell me, you know, we're all sinners and you're going to hell and you need the hope of Jesus Christ. Is like, well, would he be wrong to say that? Obviously not.
No, he would not, but it would not be effective.
What was truly effective was me realizing the truth of that claim that he never made.
Yeah.
Right? And so that is, I think, one of the things that I love about Catholicism in particular. Protestantism does not do a good job of is recognizing that this is a world that was made to live in, and that it was made to live in, to build structures, to build societies, to build cities in such a way that they give explicit and implicit glory to the Holy Trinity. And if we're not doing a good job of that, then it's going to have social ramifications, and that the kind of the effects of our sin are something that we need to do a better job of pointing out and identifying as Catholics to say, you know, these social structures that we're building, whether it is like, you know, big pharma or big tech or whatever you want to call it, that we just all see as a real problem that is inimical to our freedom, inimical to our joy, inimical to a hope for something beyond, we have to talk about those as the results of our actions, and that those are things that are making us unhappy, and that we are participating in creating them implicitly by entering into the structures and actually enabling them to exist through our purchases and our behaviors, through our lack of families, and that something along those lines would actually be relatively helpful of saying, not just we need to choose a different social order, but we actually have to have a lodestar. We have to have a North Star by which we create something practical, something concrete, something actual in the world that we can all identify as a problem and also as a solution, right? And we don't just get those solutions by following the next God king or political ruler. We have to ground it into something that's more eternal. And I think there's real hope in that. So, I mean,
A couple of things about that. First of all, the thought occurs to me that the place that I experienced this most acutely, what you're describing, and I'll share it with you so that you can correct me if I'm not getting right what you're saying, is in airports. That airports are inhuman environments that almost every human has to pass through.
Mm-hmm.
Who made the decision to make them the way they are? Who made the decision that these had to be basically low quality shopping malls where everyone's miserable, where there's no fresh air, where there's no materials that come from the earth. All everything is manufactured. Do you right. see what I'm saying?
Yes.
That who made that decision? Well, the reason that airports are what they are, to me, they're a metaphor for the whole thing that we're doing because of the choices we have made.
Right.
Do I, am I, is my, will my metaphor work or am I off?
Oh,
am
no,
I, wrong?
I think that's a great example. So if you think about kind of this, yeah, what are the symbolisms of airports, right? It is like symbolically represents the transientness of human life.
Right.
And we all experience this as Americans. Sorry if we're now kind of getting too far into the weeds on this. But
the weeds is where I want to be. Okay, I love the weeds that you get into.
Take this as an example. And I want to ground it back to, before I get into further. Is to what we're saying is that to be convinced that I'm really a sinner in need of grace, that I need to practically know that the world's not what it should be and that I'm part of the reason why it's not what it should be. I need to be experientially convinced of that, right?
Yes.
And so take the example of that airport. It's like it what is an airport? Well, it's a place where somebody can go very far away from home, yeah. right? That's what it is, right? And so therefore it's a symbol of the transientness of our modern culture,
right?
And we all experience this. The places where we're born and raised is often not the places that we now live and work, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And so the airport is kind of a symbol of that larger problem in American society, right?
Impermanence, transience, disconnection, atomization, all those things.
Right, exactly. And so you think, well, why is it that we are so depressed and anxious and on meds today? Well, there's many reasons, but a big one is that we don't have any long we don't have any friendships, right? Friendships take time. They take patterns of life that mean that I am completely dependent on you and you are completely dependent on me.
Right.
That we have built up these habits of self-giving towards others that are based in a memory and a history that takes a long time to build up,
right?
Friendships actually take time because what are they? They're actually habits. Friendships are habits of integrating your life with another, right? That takes time.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back.
Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. We are in the midst of a wonderful conversation we recently had. Let's get back to that, our conversation with Dr. Jacob Imam. And is family a form of friendship?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. This impermanence has struck the family as well, mm-hmm. this constant...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, famously says that friendship and charity are really the same thing. They're logical differences for the same essential phenomenon. So just if you think friendship, think love. Right?
Yeah.
And so what more?
It's a loveless world we've built.
Right, exactly.
That's the problem.
Right, because you don't have regularized or like customary, help me with a more normal word. You don't have standard, regular habits of self-giving to the same people over and over and over again. This is why the sacred tradition has always commended that we live in cities that are identifiable locations, right? Not because it's like they're ideologically committed to a localist idea, but the Catholic tradition has always said that we should live in places that are identifiable because that sets the occasion for virtue.
I'm going to pose you a problem though here.
Please.
Because here's another problem. Other than airports, here's my other big problem with the modern world. In the last month, I've been in Duluth, Minnesota. I've been in Covington, Kentucky. I've been in Fresno, California, and at the where the freeway meets the town. Mm-hmm. Everywhere you go in America, mm-hmm. same four restaurants. Mm-hmm. Change out one or another. Okay, it's an Arby's. It's not a Hardee's. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yep.
You go to the mall, it's the same stores.
Right.
There's a sameness everywhere. Like for some reason, the place that shocked me the most was Kentucky, because Kentucky has a personality. You know, as an American, when you think of Kentucky, you have a place in mind.
It's like the only state that really has a particularity about it. It's like horses and whiskey. You're like, there you go.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And people out in hollers and all that. It doesn't look like that. It looks like Cleveland and Des Moines and Spokane. It looks exactly the same. So I can stay in my town.
Right.
But my town is like every other town now.
Right, right. It's the same phenomenon with like Americans traveling abroad and like wanting a little taste of home. And so they go to a coffee shop because everybody's still a
They go to McDonald's. Let's be honest.
Yeah,
where
that's true. Where
they
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because they all look the same.
Which I don't think wanting a taste of home from time to time is not an evil. But the fact that I can be, you know, walking through these medieval streets of Rome, and there is literally a McDonald's in that little medieval neighborhood, that's weird.
Well, take the lesser extreme that you just posed. So the problem that you're identifying, right, is that why is it that you can go anywhere in this expansive country that we live in and walk into a city and it look, oh my goodness, so much the same as the one that's 2,000 miles away, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So then there's the question of how did it get that way? Is that actually a problem? And then what is the church? Does the church have any principles or precepts that we can use to analyze it?
But
right?
I think weren't you saying it's a problem when you're saying
I think it's a problem
that local and long term and with roots and all are if those are essentials to truly human living, mm-hmm. then the McDonald's on every corner is actually a problem. I'm not against McDonald's.
Why is it a problem? I mean, I think it is, but I don't think we've gotten to the reason yet.
Because it makes I think I'm borrowing this from Walker Percy, but it makes every place a no place.
Yeah, right.
I think that's what he said mm-hmm. about it. That
okay, so let me push you even further. Yeah. Why is having every place look the same lead to it not being any particular place? How does that happen? A, and then B, why is that a problem?
You know, I associate it with, as a matter of fact, I have a talk that I give about this, about the Harvey girls. Do you ever heard of the Harvey girls? The Harvey was the first guy that dressed all of his employees in the same clothes and fed the same, like the Harvey House restaurants were everywhere the railroad stopped out here in the West.
Oh, cool.
So he was in the 19th century, he was the Ray Kroc of the 19th century.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that since Harvey, everything has become more about efficient systems and
identifiable brands so that people no longer feel they live in a natural world. They feel they live in an artificial environment. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is the problem. McDonald's is not, is more part of an, is more artificial than it is natural. And I do think that that's a problem, especially when, it's not to say that something fabricated is bad. It's to say that when the same thing is being fabricated and imposed on the landscape everywhere, that you've lost a human factor to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not buying. I feel like you're not buying what I'm saying.
Well, no, I think it's right. Here's where I, because obviously I agree with your conclusion. I just want to get there in a sound way.
In a way that's not as stupid as the way I'm getting there. Is that what you're
I think God gave us the world in the beginning, right? You know, it's like he created the world. He then sets man in it and he commands him to till and to keep, right? You know, this is like the only story in the ancient world where God gives man work prior to the fall, right? I mean, that was Hesiod, think about it, like for the ancient Greeks, it's like there was the fall, like this divorce between the gods and man. And then because of that
now
that
you
shot relationship, yeah, then they're going to make you work and turn you into slaves and such, you know? So that is a big, big difference from Catholicism, which says, no, work was not a curse. Work is a gift, right? And so that means that what does that imply? I mean, many things, obviously. A big one, of course, is that man was given the natural world to turn it into, and I don't mean this in a negative way, an artificial one, right?
Yes, I don't dispute that.
No, I know right. You do, obviously. Right. You just said that fabrication's not good, or not bad, excuse me. that the distinction between more and more of an artificial world versus a natural one is where I'm balking slightly to say, well, it's what is the nature of the artifice that we're making? Is it particular to us? Does it reveal a particular type of relationship,
right,
to one another? And this is something that's hard for us to envision, but you know, I love my wife so much because she's not anybody else, right? You know, part of the reason why I love her so much is because she stands out, right? Think about the Song of Songs, right? Where the beloved is singing, like the apple tree amidst the forest is my lover amongst men, right? This is like, you can walk into a forest and there might be
so
many.
Beautiful.
Isn't it so great? It's like there is something different about this tree, man. You know, it's not the same, right? And that's, you know, that's how I feel about my wife, right? Is that she just stands out amongst everybody. And so there's something unique and wonderful. And as a result, we start to build up our life in a way that's also unique and hopefully also wonderful, right? And that pattern, that particular pattern of self-giving is going to make us look different than everybody else. Well, move outside the relationship of the husband and wife. That obviously is true about the kids. That should be true about the neighborhood. That should be true about the city. And not a city is, you know, taps out at a certain point. It can't just sprawl forever. And still,
right, these are nation states, the cities we have
exactly,
now.
Exactly, right. And I think there's more ways to analyze that too. But what we've created is not what you go and see on the English countryside, where there is a city with a whole bunch of houses, there's farmland all around it, and you have to walk there to the next one where there's another city, where there's another clump of buildings, right? And that's a little ways away, right? You can never tell where our cities start and where our cities end. And
that's right. We have to put up signs. Leaving, you know, San Diego County or something like
that. And that's the only way that you would ever know, right? I mean, that's crazy. And St. Thomas, in his treatise on kingship, says that part of the way that you will know that a city loves money and sets it as its proper end, like its purpose of existing, is that once you'll never be able to tell where one city ends and another begins.
Really? He saw that.
He sees that.
Wow,
you know,
wonderful.
800 years ago, right?
Yeah.
I mean, amazing mind, right? So that is definitely a telltale sign that our cities are in love with money. Why does he say that? Because everybody's going to be a merchant, like meaning that everybody's going to be principally dealing with money as their mode of occupation rather than building and supplying things or growing and raising things that you're then handing off to another,
right?
That we are all become middlemen, right? That's what a merchant is. And so insofar as we've entered into this cash nexus or this monetary economy and we're dealing with money, we want to make sure that the flow of money to the next town is as seamless and as easy as possible. And therefore, we're going to be building up businesses all along the way to the next place. And therefore, the next place, which is just another set of businesses, is going to be a seamless
And that's what
transition.
I see when I – so that's what you're describing, the roots of what I experience as unpleasant, which when I go to Kentucky, I want it to be Kentucky.
Exactly.
Dr. Jacob Imam is our guest, and we'll get back to that conversation right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. St. Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN News operates multiple global news services and digital platforms, along with news agencies in Spanish, Italian, French, Portuguese, Arabic, and German. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Dr. Jacob Imam is our guest, and we keep mentioning Walter Hooper, personal secretary to C.S. Lewis. Let's pay that off now, Dr. Jacob Imam.
I don't want you to think that I'm dismissing your ideas when occasionally I go back to asking you about you, because about 37 hours ago, I asked you about Walter Hooper, and you have never, we've never gotten to it. But I feel like I could talk to you for days, Jake. So I'm not, but I occasionally I want to bring it back how did we get here?
I would love to talk about Walter. So I was, you know, trying to get all the way to the point where I ultimately became a Protestant.
Okay.
And to make a long story short, this is actually where my story is very common, is that at some point I just saw that there is a problem in Protestant. It's like, how do you have certainty, right? And for me, in a nutshell, it came about with two issues very close to every Catholic's heart, and that was the Eucharist and that was baptism. And I was asking all the people in my Protestant church, what are these things? And nobody could give me a sound answer. It's like, well, some people think that you baptize as an infant, others as an adult. Some people say that it's a body of Christ. They don't really know what that means. Some people think it's a really nice snack, for the Eucharist, right?
Right.
And
it's
like, well, these are big deals. I mean, this is a really big deal. Why is it such a big deal? Well, it's a big deal precisely because these were things that that Jesus Christ brought up and mentioned as a way of getting to know him. Yeah. And if
Wonderful.
I don't know what they are, then that means that there is a real barrier from me enjoying a greater knowledge of Christ, and that means inherently a more intimate relationship with Christ,
right?
The more that I know about my wife, the more I get to love her, right? There's more about her that I know to love, right? That's the same thing with God, right? The more that I know about him, the more that I get to actually enter into divine intimacy with him.
And this is the essential offer that the Catholic Church makes to the whole world, but is in particular in this moment in history to Protestant people. That's good, but there's more.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
something more that it's not a matter of we want to win an argument with you.
No.
And it's partly, I think, why Protestants are often much better at arguing than Catholics are. We're not trying to win an argument. We want you to have what we have, and you can have it. Anybody can have it.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true or not?
I totally agree. Okay. I think that's the heart of it all.
Yeah, I really
think that's
and
the
that,
heart
so,
of it.
So the Eucharist and baptism.
We're practical things that made me think more theoretically about how do we know what's true about this religion that we're enjoying, right? Because ultimately it comes back to that personal truly a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, right? Which is what all the Protestants are talking about. Right. It's like, if you actually want
you want that?
Yeah. Here you go. And so I didn't really know where to turn, and there was a couple of different things. For me, it's like, one, I knew that my philosophy teacher from high school had converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. The other thing is that I was reading all these medieval texts, and now freshman year of college, right? And so I called up my old philosophy teacher and I said, hey, how do you get around this? Because there has to be an answer. And he said, well, for us Orthodox, it's tradition, right? It's the unified voice of the church fathers speaking to tell us what it is that we actually believe. Okay, that makes good sense. So I became an Orthodox catechumen.
Did you?
I did. And so I'm going through catechesis.
And where are you now? London?
No, I'm in Texas, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm in Texas. I went to Baylor University.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, good Protestant place. When I was there,
everybody that went to Baylor is happy they went to Baylor. I've never met somebody who's unhappy they went to Baylor.
Well, when I was there, they called it the Catholic Notre Dame. How great is that?
You can't say that. Yeah. That's funny.
That was a big joke in the honors department and the philosophy department.
Okay, so you enter this again. Yeah. I feel like sometimes your story is so typical. You enter the catechumenate of the Orthodox in Texas.
Yeah,
try to make it more interesting, Jacob. Make something up if you can't make it interesting.
Well, so then I talked to my old math teacher, who was an Anglican, from high school, and I said, I just kind of shared where I was with him, and to be honest, it was an extremely uncomfortable time, not knowing what was actually real. I was back almost in middle school again, trying to figure, what do I latch onto to be able to even be able to make an evaluation? I don't even have the categories that I need to be able to analyze this thing, right? And so, I was talking about tradition and all that stuff, and he, an Anglican, said to me, what you're saying makes a lot of sense, right, about tradition as being the first received truths from the apostles, right? But of course, things change over time. And the example that he gave me was what happens when Christianity moves from being a religion of the minority to a religion of the majority? Like, what happens to the empire, to Rome at that point? Are they supposed to just dismiss the fact that there is now the majority of citizens believe this one thing, and that their vision of the world is fundamentally different? It's like, don't things change then? And that just, when he said that, I was like, oh my gosh, obviously things change then. And so that was the way that I was then introduced, without the term being used, to the development of Christian doctrine.
Of course, an Anglican.
Well, praise be to Jesus Christ. He is now, this math teacher is now a very happy Catholic.
Oh,
in the ordinary.
At the Catholic. Yeah. The ordinary is just wonderful.
What a
wonderful group of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So that is when I then became a Catholic catechumen, with not giving up the Orthodox catechesis. So I went through both catechetical processes for a number of months. and that was so
helpful.
So
basically you were cheating on your catechism
teachers. Oh, totally. Yeah.
You were unfaithful to your catechism teacher.
Yeah, I was dating two girls at once.
Yeah, you were dating two churches.
Yeah, exactly.
all right. I don't know what to make of that.
I always told them both, that I was searching, right?
You were searching, what became decisive that made you a Catholic?
Yeah, two things ultimately sealed the deal for me. One was the papacy and Vladimir Solovyev's text on Russia and the Universal Church, very famous.
His basic solution was just go back.
Yeah, exactly.
And that
right.
was kind of –
Yeah. Like, but he argues in such a way as to be very convincing to somebody who's Orthodox.
Okay.
Right. The mode of his arguments being from Scripture and from the fathers is something that is very satisfying to somebody in that world, right? Huh. And so that was very helpful. And then there was just a moment of extreme charity from somebody in the church that towards the Orthodox, because I was, I was very uncomfortable where I was, like not knowing what was true.
Sure.
And so a mistake that I would often make was, or when I was around Catholics, I would say kind of negative things about the Orthodox and positive things about Catholics. And when I was around the Orthodox, I would do the same. I would say positive things about the Orthodox and negative things about the Catholics. Why? Because I was just so tired of not
fitting in.
Right?
I see it. I mean, it's
so pathetic, but it was real, right? You know? And
is it? It's not pathetic to be tired of not fitting in.
Yeah.
That's a perfectly normal human reaction.
Well, it does. It is a driver for us to settle somewhere, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, it's like the social vision of having an open mind.
Yeah.
G.K. Chesterton's like, why do you keep an open mind so that you can lock shut on something eventually?
Right.
It's like, why do you feel dissettled socially so that you might find your people,
right,
and be integrated into it.
So you were bad-mouthing the Orthodox to a Catholic.
To a Catholic, and the Catholic gave me a very insightful reason for why, in this case, I was bad-mouthing them for not developing doctrine. And they said, well, they've been under persecution for over 1,000 years. That's not a strong environment in which to develop doctrine. And that was so moving to me, his charity towards the other side. I thought, oh my gosh, it's just so interesting.
Yeah.
So again, that made me even more disposed to receive the truth. Now, ultimately, it was a lack of development on Marian doctrine. That was the other thing in addition to the papacy that was really helpful for me to choose.
Were you attracted to Mary, repulsed by Mary, indifferent to Mary?
Indifferent to Mary, but it just didn't seem like you could leave her behind.
Okay.
Right? And so it was, that was something getting over the Protestantism and also just not really know, like figuring things out. But it just seemed like one of those critical points that everybody agreed was important. And I knew that no matter what I was doing in the future, I had to have a loving relationship to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And so whoever gave the most praise to her and thought most critically about it probably was going to be right.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, your mind is really something. It's interesting, the little kind of standards that you establish. That's a perfectly reasonable standard, but who thinks of that?
So those were kind of a couple of things. And then I did move to England. And that was – but I was still, a catechumen. And I arrived on a Thursday afternoon. We're finally getting the Walter Hooper here. And Friday
the interview's over.
Friday, I'm walking through Oxford, and it's just this extremely beautiful town. And I had been there once before because I'd lived in Cambridge for a couple of months and went over to Oxford to visit. But I'm still just wandering around, just so amazed that I get to be here. And I pass this building that has a sign out front, and it says where Blessed John Henry Newman preached. It was Blessed at the time, where Gerard Manley Hopkins was a curate.
Good Lord.
And where J.R.R. Tolkien was a parishioner. And I thought, well, I'm going to go there. Yeah. So in the next, and it said, Saturday Mass, 10 a.m. So I thought, okay, great, I'll go. And I did go. And after Mass, I'm looking around for somebody with a collar on to speak with about carrying on catechesis. And there was somebody with a collar, and he's talking to an old man in the back of the church. So I kind of go up and let them have their distance a little bit, but they beckon me over and I told them my situation. Hey, you just moved here. Want to continue on with catechesis? And the man with the collar on said, oh, I'm actually not the one that you want to speak with. And he starts looking around, and the old man with him said, no, he's not the priest. He's the bishop. And I just didn't know what to look for. He wasn't wearing any purple. I can't remember a pectoral cross. But anyways, I probably just didn't know at the time. Probably it would be obvious to any Catholic. And he turns around and kind of, a little bit startled about being out. He says, well, this is the man of Oxford. This is Walter Hooper. And, of course, as you said, Walter was C.S. Lewis's secretary at the end of his life and then managed his literary estate after his death. And it really is the reason why C.S. Lewis is as well known today as he is. Lewis's books were all going out of print. Walter came up with this brilliant idea to bring everything back into print in the way in which he did it. That's a whole nother story. But we owe a lot to Walter. for that. And I owe a lot to Walter personally, because he was so excited to hear that I was a catechumen that he really took me under his wing. He taught me, you know, really how to pray the Mass better. He taught me the prayers of the church in a way that was so paternal, so fatherly, so loving. I had just lost my father a couple years before, and he filled a paternal void in my life in a really profound way. And so some months later on, when I was coming into the church, Walter was my godfather. So,
wow. And what year was this?
2015, 10 years ago.
10 years ago, yeah. You came into Castro. And then when did you start criticizing the Catholic Church? How long after?
Hey, I really hope you're enjoying this conversation with Dr. Jacob Imam. There's 40 more minutes of it. And so we've got it over at the Cy Kellett Show on YouTube. Just head on over to YouTube and search for the Cy Kellett Show. We're going to do lots more of these interviews if it turns out to be something that people like. I sure like it. And I'm very grateful that you spent the time with us right here on Catholic Answers Live. We'll see you next time, God willing.